Blog Talk Radio.
Oh shoot, I'm worried I didn't set my opening audio. Hang on a second. Hang on, everybody. Hopefully this is actually broadcasting. Okay, let's start here. Here we go. 3, 2, 1, and go.
Welcome to Philosophy in Action. I'm Greg Perkins, here with philosopher Dr. Diana Shea, where we answer your questions, applying rational principles to the challenges of real life. For those listening to the podcast, please join us live, where there's a text chat to chime in with your follow-up questions and witty comments. The show airs Sunday at 8 a.m. Pacific, 9 a.m. Mountain, 10 a.m. Central, and 11 a.m. Eastern Time at philosophyinaction.com. At the site, you can also submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows and browse the archives from past shows. Now, with all of that out of the way, let's jump over to the star of the show, Dr. Diana Shea.
Happy Sunday, everyone. Greg, are you there? Greg? Oh, goodness. What's happened? I don't know whether people can hear me in the chat. Greg, I don't know where you are. By gosh, by golly. Okay, hang on a second, folks. Let's figure this out. Okay, so Trey can hear me. Greg, where did you go? Okay, hang on, folks. We're just gonna get everything working and then start afresh here. So, you know, it's funny that this has never happened before. Okay. Okay, so I'm trying to figure out with Greg where he's gone. Audio hijack issues on his end. Okay. That's odd. Okay, so we're just going to wait until Greg catches up with us, and then we'll start. I mean, there's no point in me going on here. But hi, everybody. How are you doing? This will only be for the live show. I will actually cut this out of the podcast, which hopefully I will actually do that rather than just saying that, and then it shows up on the podcast. Yeah, Greg cannot be trying to catch up to me on Candy Crush Soda, A, because he's not so silly as to play, but you, I know, are trying to catch up with me on Candy Crush Soda, Trey. There you are, Greg.
Thing. Oh, this is really not cool.
Do you think is it stable now? Is it,
I don't know. It did it once before, and it did just now. So if I vanish, you'll know what happened.
Okay. Okay.
What the hell?
Well,
okay, anyway, happy Sunday.
Wait. Let's, for the sake of the recording, let's give it, 2 seconds of silence, and then you can do happy Sunday, and we'll get started. So, go ahead.
Okay. Happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday, Greg. Happy technical problem Sunday, which hopefully we will not be hearing on the podcast. So, Greg, tell us what we have on tap this week.
All right. We do, in fact, have a great set of questions on fraud and deception, people unworthy of the truth, deception in a business partner, and more. Kind of noticing a theme there.
Yeah, yeah, we're doing. I decided to pick 3 questions on honesty. It wasn't really a deliberate plan, but I just sort of had 3 on honesty, and I was like, oh, let's try this. So I generally don't like to do questions on a theme, at least when I've considered in the past, I have said, no thanks, like 3 parenting questions or something like that. But this is a kind of moral theme, which I sort of like better. So we'll see how this goes, and folks, feel free to shoot me an email and give me some feedback if you like this format or you didn't like this going on a theme. Also, remember, if you're listening live, you can post questions and comments in the text chat over at philosophyinaction.com/live. And I fear that Greg has disappeared again. Anyway, so news of the week this week. We're actually wrapping up here in Aiken, so we're leaving. I'm not sure whether we're going to be leaving tomorrow or on Tuesday, but then we're headed home. We have a 2-day long, long drive home, and then SnowCon is going to be happening the week after that, so running from the 17th to the 22nd, and you can still sign up for that. There's definitely lots of, you know, we've got space for people, and we've got great snow. February was the snowiest month on record in Colorado, and so folks who are interested in snow sports or just hanging out or snowshoeing or doing anything fun with other friends and so on might want to check that out and join us, even if it's last minute. Okay, so Greg is really not here. Greg, I assume you're really not here. This is a problem. Okay, so I don't want to start the first question. I just don't have anything else to do right now, folks. Sorry, I don't have anything to tell you about exciting about my life or what's going on, so we're just going to hang out and wait for Greg and see if he can get this problem fixed in a more permanent way. He says, I'm going to need to do the conga, and he's killing this piece of crap. So that's fine. I can do the conga. That's certainly possible. Okay, so, but I'm still going to wait for him to come back. Just waiting for you to start to conga.
Good grief.
There you are.
Can you hear me?
There you are.
I couldn't be more irritated. This is horrible. Dang thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. You'll need to do the conga action.
I will happily do the conga, so obviously that's another piece I'm going to have to cut out,
right.
Hopefully the last one. Okay, so I'm going to conga, and then we'll start with question one here.
All right. Fractional reserve banking and deception. Does fraud require deliberate deception? Some libertarians, most notably Walter Block, have tried to argue that fraud does not require deliberate deception. For example, argues Block, if I try to sell you a square circle, and I believe that square circles existed, and you did too, and you agreed to the transaction, then since square circles do not actually exist, this would still count as fraud, even though no deliberate deception has taken place. Block has used this argument to indict fractional reserve banking by arguing that it still counts as fraud, even though all parties are knowingly consenting. Is he talking rationalistic nonsense?
Yes. Like, my thought here is like, oh, libertarians and your rationalistic nonsense, right? Thankfully, actually, I did stumble upon a really great article because I was searching for the actual quote by Walter Block just to make sure that this argument that's represented here was actually one that he's given. And I stumbled upon this great article by a libertarian who I've really liked for a very long time, Wendy McElroy. And she just has a really, really nice article on what's wrong with this view of reserve banking. And I'm actually going to draw upon a lot of her points here. It's not that she said anything that was particularly new to me, but she said it so well, I was really very impressed. So if you're interested in more about that, that's definitely a place to go.
Ooh, I'm intrigued. So what's the basic argument about fractional reserve banking?
Yeah, I mean, the reason, originally I thought, oh, let's just deal with this fraud and deception issue. That week. Maybe I'll have a side note at the end about fractional reserve banking. But the problem with that is that this argument that they're giving is so tied up with the whole, with their view of fractional reserve banking. It's a way, like, you can't understand what they're trying to do with this argument unless you understand what their problem is with fractional reserve banking. And then... Mm. And then I'm going to say a little bit more about deception and deliberate deception, whether that's required for fraud. But that's actually a topic in the law that's sort of huge. This fractional reserve banking argument is a bit easier to tackle. Okay, so fractional reserve banking, for those of you who are not familiar with it, this is the definition that Wendy McElroy gives in her article, which I think is good. It's very neutral. It's accurate. It's the practice by which a bank maintains available reserves that represent only a portion of its customers' deposits while lending out or investing the rest, close quote. So the idea is, let's say I deposit $1,000 at my bank. They only actually keep around, as sort of the held portion, 10% of that. So they only keep around $100, and the rest is lent out as a business loan to my neighbor who, you know, uses it to expand his business, and then he, you know, he pays back the bank. And what happens is then if I needed, let's say I needed $900, even though my money, quote unquote, my money has been lent out, there's just this aggregate of deposits, and there's the demand for deposits at any given time is not that huge. And so I'm able to rely upon sort of the aggregate of deposits when I, say, want more than my 10% that would be held on hand. And
so this works great unless everybody wants their money at once.
Yeah,
that would be
yeah,
like a bank run.
That would be a problem, right? And the question here is that fraud? Is that system fraud? Or in other words, is it a kind of rights violation there? Even if it's practiced not in our government system that we have today with tons of government regulations and government mandated fractional reserve banking and government setting the limits on fractional reserves and so on. But would this be fraud if practiced in a wholly free system of purely price, where depositors would know the percentage that was kept in reserve at the bank? And you might even have it printed on banknotes, right?
Yeah.
And the idea in that case, so the idea here is, look, if you do that system, like let's say I opted for a fractional reserve bank rather than a storage bank, or a fractional reserve account rather than a storage account, I would then be paid interest rather than paying storage fees, right? And I would understand the bank, it would be their job to make me understand that I would be taking a risk that the money might not be available if everybody wanted their money in the way that you said, Greg, right? If we have a bank run, or that my money could be lost in a bank failure.
Yeah. So it's just not 100% liquid, and there's risk because it's an investment.
Right, right. But, and so the question is that fraud?
Yeah. Well, in a wholly free society, it sounds like it would be a matter of contract.
One would think, right? But there's all these sort of like anarchist-type libertarians like Murray Rothbard, Walter Block, and George Reisman even has this view. He's not an anarchist, but he's a well-versed economist. I did expect better from him. That their view is that this would be fraud. And in part it would be fraud because if everyone demanded their money back from the bank couldn't provide it. And but in response, right, you say, but look, people know this. People, there's no deception here. It's, you know, the terms are known to anybody. People know that this is a possibility. This is where Block says, this is where he gives the argument that's summarized in the question. And I'll read the actual argument here. Quote, but lying is only sufficient for fraud, not necessary. There are other ways to commit fraud besides an outright lie. For example, it is fraudulent for a bank or anyone else to try to sell you a square circle, even if they do not lie about it, because there's no such thing as a square circle. And in order for a contract to be a valid one, not only must both parties agree to it, lies to the other, but also, the contract must be in accordance with logic, close quote. It's a sort of odd argument, right?
Oh, interesting.
And you might wonder, like, what does it mean that the contract has to be in accordance with logic? And it's actually capitalized, at least in the version that I saw, right?
Yeah.
Contractual terms, like, they need to be logical, they need to be rational, in the sense that they can be understood, they can be complied with, and so on. But the fractional reserve banking, according to these libertarians, like that's not the problem, right? The buyer here, the depositor, they understand the terms, right? The problem is, and this is Reisman gives this argument. The problem is, according to him, fractional reserve banking violates the law of excluded middle. In other words, the law that says a thing cannot be both, you know, A and not A at the same time and in the same respect. This is pretty amazing, right? You've got a method of banking that violates the law of excluded middle. And he says, quote, that fractional reserve banking, quote, attempts to cheat reality by getting away with a contradiction, close quote. And the way in which the contradiction here is the depositor aims to have his money, in other words, have access to it and lend it to. So you're having trying to, have your cake and eat it too. You're having to have your money and lend it too.
So he's objecting that you're trying to do too much, two things at once. Kind of like a dessert topping and a floor wax. You can't do that.
Right. Yeah. And like this argument though, this is nothing short of extremely, extremely silly. The depositor is freely allowing his money to be lent in exchange for interest, but he knows that if he wants his money, he's relying on the deposited funds, right? And there's a risk that that's going to be unavailable in cases of high demand. And the one thing I did get from Wendy McElroy's article that was new is the following. She said, look, this is not new. This isn't that's crazy and wild. We actually rely on this kind of aggregation of funds for the operation homeowner's insurance. My payout, we had our bathroom flood disaster a couple years ago, and our insurance company paid us some number of thousands of dollars for that. We relied on sort of the aggregate of funds for that they had available from other people's payments, everybody's payments. And there's just this ongoing, people are paying in all their premiums, and there's a kind of outflow of funds. And we know that in certain cases, like in cases of natural disaster, it might be the case that you do get the insurance company gets in real trouble and they cannot pay out all their claims. But that's no different, right? You can't say, well, but what if everybody made insurance claims? Then, yeah, like the business would fail and people would be stuck in that way.
Insurance companies that make bad calculations do fail.
Right. Yeah, particularly ones that don't spread their, spread their risk around in, lots of different locations, for example. That's actually really important. But it's you don't say that I'm trying to have my cake and eat it too in those kind of cases, even though, yes, I know I'm relying on the aggregate of funds if I am making an insurance claim. That's just not. This is like it's a feature. It's not a bug, right? It's a feature that we can do this. It's not a bug.
And I don't recall any libertarian anarchist types denouncing insurance.
Right. Yeah.
All right. So, what about the more general question of whether deliberate deception is required for fraud?
Yeah, and Greg, you had some thoughts here. I thought you might be able to get us started about I don't know what.
Yeah. So.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
You had some good thoughts.
I'll try a little riff on it here. So in my head, when we started the discussion, I was like, well, okay, I have a basic notion of fraud. It just means lying to someone to gain something. It's a knowing deception. I mean, that'll really get you there. The whole purpose of it is to get something you otherwise wouldn't get by misleading somebody. So that's and Block is going a little further than that. A lot further than that. He's trying to argue that fraud can be the result of any falsehood, not me trying to mislead you to get something, but even us both being fooled or stuff just happening and my gaining maybe. It's like, okay. The problem is that that's not excluding cases where the buyer should have known better, like dealing with psychics and television priests, pastors, those kinds of jokers. And there it's like, oh, come on, you should have been paying attention. You had it within your grasp to go, hey, wait a minute, this doesn't really seem completely right. So I think that the actual correct position is somewhere in between these two at this place. It's that fraud requires that you knew the claims were false or that you should have known, like you're a professional, like a doctor. You could... Basically, it's an idea of a negligence. So, if they were negligent in saying something because you took them as an okay, and you were misled by that, then that could be a kind of fraud in my mind.
Yeah.
So either you knew it was false or you should have known it was false, and kind of the rest we can work out from there.
Yeah, and I do think the way that the law handles fraud, it's a really complex topic, and so neither Greg or I here are qualified to comment. But the view that Greg and I came to, which I do think you see in the law, at least to some extent, is that you can have deception. The deception involved in fraud can either be this intentional or a negligent sort. It can be like you knew this was false, or you should have known. The should have known, that's the negligence part. So let's just tease out these two categories. So you can have an intentional deception. So you're aiming, the seller, let's say, is aiming to deceive. They're deliberately lying or concealing information. So, for example, a real estate agent might claim that a house was inspected for radon and cleared, even when they know that the report, which they've seen, it showed dangerously high levels. Like, that would be an outright case of intentional deception. But you can also have negligent deception, meaning that the person is careless with the truth, likely by they're representing unwarranted assumptions as settled facts. So that same real estate agent might say, oh, yeah, these radon levels, they're nothing to worry about, even though they don't actually know, they haven't seen a report. They just, let's say maybe they know that a report was done, and they they say, well, look, the sellers would have told me something if the levels were high, right? Like,
yeah.
that's negligence, right? If you're going to say it's nothing to worry about, you should actually have, relevant evidence.
And this is the sort of person that you might take as being somewhat of an authority. It's like, oh, you're in that business. You do this all the time.
Right.
And you're telling me with confidence that it's okay.
Right, because you're representing yourself as having seen the, as having seen the report. Now, but there are these cases then that we had this interesting discussion about, the cases of psychics and so on, right? Because it's not the case that any false belief on the part of the people doing the buying and selling makes the transaction fraudulent. And, I mean, look, we see all the time, there's all kinds of trades that involve false beliefs. Right, the belief that prayer is effective, the belief that psychics have this, secret insight, the belief that recycling saves the earth, the belief that we're all going to die in a global heat wave, so we have to do something about our carbon emissions, et cetera, right? When people believe these things, the buyer there, he's failing to exercise due care in his opinions. He's got an obligation to have some greater epistemic care here. So if he's defrauded in a sense, he defrauded himself, right, seller, and likely based, mistake or irrationality, right? But the idea that the buyer then is somehow uniquely entitled to sue the seller and win damages, even though he was irresponsible, it was his own mistake on something that he had an obligation to make sure he was right on. No way, man, right?
Yeah.
He's getting exactly what he wanted. There's no dishonesty involved. That's a caveat emptor kind of situation.
Yeah. So the idea here is that it's not all on the
seller.
It's the seller. The buyer has to exercise some caution, some sense.
Right.
And so if he's being negligent epistemologically, then it's on him. Just
right.
Like if the other person's being negligent, it's on him. So.
Right.
So that's where it gets interesting, because it's like, all right, I was being reasonable in trusting someone who's a veteran in this industry and telling me confidently it was okay. I wasn't being a complete goofball like I would be if I fell for some stupid psychic.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, the issue, the fraud issue comes up when we do have the seller representing himself as an authority, even like either on sort of general principles like a doctor would be, or let's say on this particular house, like, yes, I've looked at the radon report and it's fine. He's representing himself as an authority, and he's making these either false or baseless claims or being careless with the truth. And in those kind of cases, then you can say, look, there's no meeting of the minds. The trade was not what the buyer supposed it was. It was based on, the trade happened, it was based on this kind of falsehood. And again, there's lots more to fraud in the law, but I do think that there's a distinction here between cases in which, look, the buyer had the obligation to make sure that he got his own beliefs straight, versus cases when the seller is using his greater knowledge and greater authority to deceive. And I will mention here, so, I mean, just imagine what would happen if any false belief relevant to a transaction made that fraud. So anything of the sort of, I think I'm going to have my money and lend it to, like that kind of false belief, if that counted as fraud. Well, the government would end up dictating through fraud claims what would count as the truth on religion and on medicine and on ethics and everything else. Because tons and tons of transactions would count as fraudulent all of a sudden. Even though you had a meeting of the minds and everybody, even in cases where everybody, there's mutual satisfaction, that would count as fraud.
Yeah, this is incredibly dangerous, though.
Oh, I know. I know. Like, nothing like a bad libertarian anarchist argument to usher in totalitarianism. Like, woo, thanks, guys.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, and this kind of an undercurrent in everything we've been talking about. This is why we were leaning this direction in the first place, because we do not want to have government be the arbiter of what is true and good.
Right.
That is the most dangerous thing you could do. Instead, we really want to protect rights. We want to protect the conditions necessary for people to discover what is true and good. And outlawing fraud is what lets us do that. It's like, oh, okay, you're not trying to sabotage that person trying to figure out the right thing. That's enough.
Yeah.
All right, so what's your take-home point?
So the libertarian arguments about fractional reserve banking, as being inherently fraudulent are wrong and silly. False beliefs do not render transactions fraudulent. Some kind of intentional or negligent deception is required.
Awesome. I saw a lot of chit-chat go by, but I did not see any follow-ups. Did you see some follow-ups?
Mm-hmm. No, the only thing that I would mention is on this issue of fractional reserve banking, just because I think that this is, I say, look, this is a legitimate practice, it's not fraud, doesn't mean that I would defend the government policies on this, or that I would say that under a fractional reserve system, I have a right to my money. Like I have a, you cannot, the bank cannot, here's what would be fraud. If the bank guaranteed that I would always be able to get my deposit back, get my deposits at any time in a system of fractional reserve banking, that would be fraud. That they cannot guarantee. So I do think that there's a potential for fraud here, and there's certainly a potential for rights violations when you get the government involved. But I think that fractional reserve banking can be done honestly, and that's actually it's a fabulous innovation in so many ways, because you don't have to say, okay, this is the money that I have in storage and this is the money that I have in investments. Because of you know, pooling of money, you can be much more fluid about that.
Yeah. And in that area, somebody asks, for a bank that would operate on this kind of basis, is there a responsibility to disclose its agreements that funds may not be available? And would that settle the fraud question?
You would think it would, but it doesn't for these libertarians. They think that the fraud is inherent in the system itself. It doesn't matter what kind of disclosures are made.
Yeah. And I think if you have an innovative solution like this, if your customer doesn't understand it, you need to make sure they understand it. It's like you, when you're forming a contract, you've got to have that meeting of the minds.
Right. Right.
So in our society, even though we are compelled to use a certain banknote and fractional reserve banking, everybody knows exactly what's going on.
Right.
And we know that it's arbitrary, too. They can turn the dials up and down any way they please. They can print more of the basis money anytime they please.
Yeah,
it's
what we're defending
control.
Here, right?
No, we are not defending the current banking system. It's just the concept of fractional reserve banking.
Yeah.
Okay, so with that, it's time for the reminder about the tip jar.
So Philosophy in Action Radio, not just the live show, but the podcast, too, is available to anyone free of charge. That's because we want to spread rational principles far and wide. And we do that with each and every show to thousands of listeners, but we can't accomplish that alone. We do rely on the support of our fans. So if you value our work, please do contribute to our tip jar. You can visit philosophyinaction.com/support to send money online or via the mail. We suggest $5 per episode or $20 per month, but any amount is welcome. Also, you can create a recurring monthly tip via PayPal, Dwolla, or your bank's bill pay. Then you don't need to remember, and we really appreciate that regular support. Again, you can do that over at philosophyinaction.com/support.
Cue the conga. People unworthy of the truth. Are some people unworthy of the truth? Quote, never tell the truth to people who are not worthy of it, unquote, said Mark Twain in his notebooks. Is that true? Does that justify lying or withholding information?
So I'm not sure here of Mark Twain's actual context or meaning, because there isn't a version of his notebooks online that I could find easily, at least. And if I Googled for this quote, all that I found was, you know, this single quote. So I don't know if there was more context. But as just taken as advice, if this is sort of how the thought stands, you know, should you live by this principle or not? No, this is really bad advice. It really seems like, well, look, I don't like you, so I'm entitled to lie to you as I please. And basically it's an excuse for dealing in this underhanded, deceptive way with other people by deceiving them, manipulating them, trying to control them, based on this attitude of contemptuous superiority, like you are not worthy, right? Dude, this is wrong. This is unjustified.
Jeez.
This is dangerous. Yeah, this is bad news. Bad news all around. I mean, look, when I speak, when I actually communicate with other people, unless I'm in a case where my rights are being violated, unless there's a thug, you know, a mugger holding a gun to my head, I'm going to speak the truth. And if I dislike or distrust or despise a person, I'm not going to engage in this pretense of dealing with them by telling them lies. No. I'm going to protect myself by keeping my distance in those kind of cases. So maybe I won't communicate much to them. Maybe I won't communicate anything to them. Maybe I'll be communicating with other people. Or better yet, like with these kind of people, better yet, just not have anything to do with the person if you can.
Yeah, so you maintain some sort of a distance.
Yep.
You have appropriate boundaries.
Yeah, you're discreet about what you're telling them. But if I'm communicating with that person, I'm going to be telling that person the truth. And the reason is because reality is my best friend. Reality is my best protection against bad people, against people that I, you know, dislike and distrust and so on. Like, forget what you owe to the other person. You owe that to yourself to tell the truth, because that's what actually is your best protection. And this is, we ended up in this conversation about people who claim that they need to lie as a matter of self-defense. And I'm not talking about a rights kind of situation here. I'm talking about they're lying to protect their interests against the schemes of others, right? These are people who are actually, they are the worst kinds of schemers themselves. They are deceiving themselves about what's going on. These kinds of people who feel themselves entitled to lie to protect their interests, they are in fact the worst kinds of schemers and manipulators. And what they do is they project their own mindset onto other people. So other people are trying to go about their life and be honest traders, and every movement of those people is seen as, you know, manipulative and controlling,
yeah,
and so on. And that, because that's
scheming
how
and
they
positioning
operate.
And manipulating. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And what happens, I mean, I really think so many of these people, they default on the responsibility of acting on the virtue of justice. So, and by that I mean they're not willing to exert the effort of judging people as good or bad and then acting on that knowledge and saying, look, these are the good people who I'm going to deal with and these are the kind of people I'm not going to deal with. They're thinking of everybody as scheming manipulators, which is what they are, and they're
yeah,
going to try to scheme and manipulate them, right?
Project much? I mean, geez.
I know. And I also think that these kind of people, they're real cowards. Like, they are really unwilling to deal with people squarely for fear of exposure and disapproval. I mean, it's just basically think of these people as trying to use dishonesty to compensate for their failures to practice the justice of, or failures to practice the virtues of justice and independence. Like, dude, this is not a path to success here, right? And meanwhile, then they cultivate this attitude of contempt for others and superiority over others, this, like, you're not worthy of the truth, which is wholly unjustified. Like, these people are the lowest of the low. These are the bottom feeders, right? So there's nothing good about this. There's nothing good about having this attitude towards other people. There's nothing good about adopting this approach of justifying one's dishonesty.
Yeah. Even and this goes even to the notion of a privacy lies, where it's like, well, you're just a snoop and you're not entitled to that information, so I'll fib you. It's like, hey, that's and I believe you've talked about this before, where the idea is you need to be a little more responsible with setting up your boundaries so he doesn't have an expectation that they can ask you for that kind of thing, and they'll understand that when you say, I'm not going to talk about that, you're not confirming it by refusing to talk.
Yeah.
Because that's why people justify it. They say, hey,
right,
when did you sleep with the boss's wife? I'm not going to talk about my sex life with you. Ah, I see. Thanks for confirming it. It's like, well,
right,
they would never take that as a confirmation if all the times before that, when they asked you about your sex life, you actually didn't talk about your sex life.
Right, right.
So
yeah,
it's some work, but hey, guess what? It's really good because you keep reality on your side.
I would agree. I mean, I have enough trouble remembering the truth that trying to remember multiple versions, like,
yeah,
I just can't imagine. But it was really, it's really the contempt for other people that struck me about this quote.
Oh, yeah,
I mean, I would never think of people who are, like, unworthy of the truth. Like, dude, like, you might be unworthy of private information about my life, but, like, unworthy of the truth? Like, ugh, I don't know.
That's just weird, yeah.
That creeps me out in a big way.
So, and that goes to also, hey, I have a lot of really decent people around me. I don't want to project a notion to people I like and that I want to deal with that, yeah, by the way, you just be on notice. Here's my standing policy. If I think you're a poopy head at some point, which you probably can't tell, I'll just start lying to you and doing what I want. And it's like, oh, yeah, that's a great way to build trust with the people around you. That's nice. That's why instead I tell them something similar to what you said earlier, which is, look, my policy is I may exercise a lot of tact. I may not be willing to talk about something you want to talk about, but when I do say something, it will be true unless somebody has a gun to my head and I'm trying to stop someone from being killed right now.
Right. Right. Yeah.
It has to be a matter of life and death because some thug is trying to get someone dead that I would start doing that, and then it is clearly self-defense. So you can be on notice that unless you're actually threatening me or somebody I love physically, you're going to get the truth out of me if you get anything out of me.
Right. Right. Yeah.
All right. So
I would not want to live any other way. And I just, you know, it's, I don't know, seeing the people in this light of this pretense and scheming and manipulating, it's just, it's so repulsive. It just, it truly makes you, it makes you the kind of person who is quote unquote unworthy of the truth. Yeah. So
yeah, it's kind of ironic, isn't it?
Yes.
And I have been surprised a few times. I've had contact with people that I'm going along and I'm dealing with them, just assuming we're all in a nice trading, happy relationship, and all of a sudden one of these sharp corners pokes out of this projection, looking at what I've just said or done in this way as if I was busy scheming and manipulating, and it's like or seeing it with somebody else, just watching through this person's eyes, it's just like, wow, it's jarring. I don't like that place.
Yeah.
I don't want to deal with people that way.
Exactly.
All right. So,
take home.
What's the take home point?
So a decent person deals with other people squarely, whether by communicating honestly with them or just keeping away from them. Attempting to justify deception on the grounds that others are unworthy destroys a person's character and makes them unworthy by their own standards.
Indeed. A little bit of follow-up action here. Lauren asks, what if it's a shop clerk asking you the simple, how are you doing?
Fine is a fine answer.
In our culture, it's a reasonable answer.
Yeah. I don't think there's anything dishonest about that. I mean, like, unless you're actually, like, you know, like, you should be going to a hospital because your appendix is bursting or something like that, in which case you shouldn't be shopping, right? I mean, there's yeah. times at which you would truly not be able to answer the question of, say, fine, which, like, hey, look, I'm out shopping, is times where you shouldn't be out shopping. Yeah.
And usually we understand in our culture that when someone asks that, they're not actually asking you for a deep assessment of your current position in life.
Right.
They're just saying hello, essentially. And
yeah.
When you say fine, you're saying hello back. It's
right.
Really, that's the protocol.
Right.
So it's not like you're lying or deceiving anyone. If you're having kind of a rough day and you say I'm fine, or if you're having a fantastic day and you just don't want to go in and you say I'm doing good.
I read a really funny article about a gal who was over living in Germany and some of the cultural mistakes that she made. I love these kind of articles. And she said one of the differences is that she was just used to having these kind of like, hey, how are you? You know, fine. How are you doing? Fine. Like that being a kind of greeting. But in Germany,
yep.
If you ask how are you, they really mean it seriously. So they used to be puzzled and puzzled about like, what is she doing? What is she saying? And then at one point somebody said, you really want to know? And she said, yeah. And so he gives her this like half hour diatribe about how his life is sucking and all this like too much information and so on. And she's like, whoa, okay. Going to
yeah.
stop asking that question.
And I think that's pretty interesting. That's why I said in our culture, because I actually find it a little irritating that we can't just say hello and hello back.
Right.
And it's
right.
Like, okay, the protocol here, I get it.
Right.
And it's hilarious that in Germany, nope, they don't
yep.
have that. And when you ask, they assume you want the deep,
the real deal. Yep.
Introspective thing. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
All right. And David asks, might this be an acceptable way of dealing with truly terrible people who you are otherwise powerless to deal with? For example, a reasonable teenager dealing with his abusive, religious, committedly irrational parents until he becomes independent.
You know, I do think that I think it's really hard in those kind of cases. I think that if it's that bad, work to become financially independent and secure, get emancipated. If it's that bad, if you cannot be just a little bit certain, like if being circumspect and, you know, let's say not, you know, keeping your own privacy and being more general about, how is your day today, right?
Exercising a lot of tact.
Yeah, a lot of tact and a lot of discretion about what you tell them. If that's not possible, if it's truly so bad that they're, you know, they're sitting you down and grilling you about your religious views every night and so on, I don't know. I mean, maybe getting emancipated is the thing to do. I hate to say it, but I think that teenagers lying to their parents is I think that's understandable. with certain kinds of parents, not, you know, hopefully not, probably many fewer parents than I think teenagers think, right? But for truly, truly terrible, for terrible parents, who you're just trying to muddle through and get on your way, I certainly wouldn't condemn a teenager. I think that there's a real difference when you have choices about who you're associating with, and people who choose to continue relations with people and then lie to them, that I think is inexcusable. That's where the real problem is. That's where you get the scheming and manipulating.
Oh. Yeah. Very interesting stuff. So, moving on, why don't you remind listeners about your podcast on finding good prospects for romance and friendship?
Yeah, so this 90-minute podcast discusses how to make yourself a good prospect and how to find good prospects for romance and friendship. In other words, how to avoid the schemers and so on. You can preview over 30 minutes of the podcast over at philosophyinaction.com/romancecast, and then you can purchase access to the full 90-minute podcast for just $15. And the reason I put this in here was because I got a really lovely comment with an order yesterday from somebody who's a regular contributor. And this person said, quote, "Philosophy in Action has played a central role in my personal growth and navigation of great ideas over the last several years, and I have every reason to believe this podcast will be both thoughtful and useful. I'm generally quite good at interacting with strangers, but selecting friends and reeling them in is still a challenge," quote, unquote. So
yeah.
Anyway, I thought that was really lovely, and again, you can find all that over at philosophyinaction.com/romancecast.
Indeed, and Tammy heartily endorses that particular program. She really loved it.
Yeah, even though she had found her good romantic prospect by the time she listened to it. So
yeah, but it's not all about the romance.
No, a lot of, because
like
part of the point that I make in this is that it's not like that there's the method by which one should look for a romantic partner is not fundamentally different from the way one should look for friends. That it's all, even though I do think romantic relationships are a different in kind from friendships, the way you go about finding the appropriate people, the way you end up finding compatible people, is very much the same.
Indeed. All right, moving on. Anna?
Yeah, I'm trying.
Oh, okay. I didn't know if you were waiting on me.
Let's do it again. Or maybe not.
Awesome. All right. Deception in a business partner. How can I decide whether a business associate has crossed the line? I'm part of a very specialized marketing co-op group. Businesses provide samples to the marketer, who then sells them at his own profit to the tune of thousands of dollars a month. The marketer also does many web promotions and a monthly set of videos to promote the makers of these samples. This business has worked well in sending customers my way in the past. However, a few months ago, the marketer threatened to call the whole thing.
Okay, folks, so Greg, Blog Talk Radio hung up on us. In the middle of Greg's reading the question. So I think let's conga and start the question over again, because I'm not sure exactly where we hung up. Okay,
there.
So sorry about that, folks. It really is technical problems Sunday. Okay, hang on. Here's the conga.
Deception in a business partner. How can I decide whether a business associate has crossed the line? I'm part of a very specialized marketing co-op group. Businesses provide samples to the marketer, who then sells them at his own profit to the tune of thousands of dollars a month. The marketer also does many web promotions and a monthly set of videos to promote the makers of these samples. The business has worked well in sending customers my way in the past. However, a few months ago, the marketer threatened to call the whole thing off for a month, claiming that there was not enough samples to sell. So all the businesses rallied and sent in more. 2 weeks later, the marketer posted publicly that his spouse's hours had been cut the month before and he was strapped for cash. This apparent dishonesty turned me off from using the service for many months. When I finally sent in samples again, I found that the same thing is still happening. The marketer is threatening to call off the promotion for the month if more samples are not sent in. Does this kind of behavior warrant dropping this business tool from my arsenal, or am I just reacting emotionally?
So it was interesting because Greg and I both had the same initial thought. And actually, like, I wrote it down, and then he said exactly what I had typed up when we were having our production meeting.
Yeah. And basically, I couldn't see you typing it.
No, it was totally independent. So both of us thought, look, there's major red flags here, so don't get deeply involved, don't make any long-term commitments, but make a kind of cost-benefit analysis, like consider what value you gain from this marketing plan, figure out whether it's worth continuing or not. No, like, yeah, this is a problem, this is a worry, but maybe you can manage it so you can gain value here without much risk.
Yeah.
That was our first thought. And then as we discussed those risks, it just became increasingly clear that was the wrong approach. There is just, like, there's way too much danger here. Like, run away from this mess as fast as you can.
Which took us back to, look, the discussion of red flag people, the bottom line is don't deal with them. You can't manage them. They're red flag people for a reason.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and this marketer, he is waving. Like, he's got, like, 12 red flags up there. He's flying them high. His behavior is really fishy. The threats, the claims about, like, how he's lost income and so on. I mean, like, and look, you've already given him a second chance, and yet you've come back and the same thing is happening. And so this guy from this description, he seems erratic. He seems manipulative. He seems underhanded. He seems dishonest. And he basically seems like a sleazy guy, and you should not want to deal with him. You should not want to deal with that kind of sleazy immorality. And the issue is not just an emotional one. It's not just that it's repulsive to deal with people like this. The issue is that it's impossible to manage a relationship with that kind of person so that it's actually to your benefit. Right? You can try, but in the end, you always end up with the short end of the stick in these kind of cases. Right? You're a piker. You're a dilettante. But he's an expert in being sleazy. He's an expert in conning and manipulating because that's what he does all day long.
Yeah, and he does this all the time. How are you going to guess all the ways he's going to – you don't live in that world.
Right.
You don't want to live in that world.
And you're also – I mean, you're a decent person, right? So you're limited to morally decent actions. And you're also – you're limited by wanting to create a win-win relationship to have a fair trade with him. Well, he's not, right? If he is this kind of sleazy person, which he's definitely advertising that that's the kind of person he is, he's going to do anything to get as much as possible from you, and he doesn't care if you lose in the process. So if you try to play his game, if you try to play a game with him, he's always going to win unless you become as sleazy as he is, and really that's not what you want here, right? I mean, this is just There's no way to win this. And, Greg, this is a lesson that you have learned, unfortunately, personally.
Yeah. We've dealt with people who are not the best. And sure enough, you think, oh, yeah, there's the red flags, but we can manage this.
Right.
But it's exactly as you said. In the end, it ends up being super frustrating. It takes so much energy, so much work to try to manage them. And then you end up losing in the end anyway, because not only is it polluting your soul with all of this goofiness, they can always do something more goofy than you can imagine.
Right.
They can do something more bold than you would ever think someone could pull off. We had this guy who messed up the construction of our house. He sat there right at our table, and when confronted, he was like, well, of course I lied to you. He was downright proud of it, and we were just like jaw in lap.
Wow.
Admitted,
I mean,
what the hell?
And you cannot force people to be rational. You cannot force them to be fair. It doesn't matter how many facts you present before them. You can't force them to be decent, right? And you think, like, because you think, if I were in that position, I would have to give in and say, here, take all my money. I can't take it anymore. I'm a horrible person. And yeah, but that's not what these people are going to do. Yeah,
because you're the sort of person when you see when the cards are all laid down and you've messed up, you're like, let me fix this. Not with them. They'll find some other fun play because they don't care about that.
Right.
So this is the same kind of thing that goes on, actually, with the someone's wrong on the internet. If only I show them the perfect argument, this I will force them to confront the truth, and they will do the right thing. No, not if they're evading in the first place and they're goofy.
Right.
I've just wasted my time.
Yeah. Yeah, you cannot force a mind. And this is something, like, this is really hard to recognize, even for people who know this, who understand this, who have read Atlas Shrugged back and forth, and you go, like, you can't force a mind. And then you're like, but wait, if I just give you the perfect argument, right? No.
If someone's intent on fooling themselves, on evading, on not going there, not even just being an outright thug, if you're just intent on not seeing it, they will blink every time. I've watched it happen over and over.
Yep.
Anywho.
Yeah, so. I mean, and the thing is that I do just want to mention, like, even if you stay connected to this guy, and even if you try to stay at arm's length, I mean, there's all kinds of, there's sort of no limit to the bad things that might happen to you. I mean, if he does something really dishonest and there's some kind of scandal about it, you could be associated with that in people's minds. I mean, you know, there could be news reports written about it and you're one of his associates. It might be that he would conduct a whispering campaign against you at some point. He might use disreputable means to promote your product that actually really do you damage. He might outright cheat your customers. He could sue you, and so on. Like, there's just so many risks in dealing with this kind of person. You do not want to take those kinds of risks.
This is what actually woke us up to, hey, wait a minute. Our initial take on this was really not the way to think about it, because when you think about the risks, once we put ourselves in this mindset and worked at thinking about all the devious, goofy, completely unreasonable things that some red flag person could do, we went, wow, that risk analysis is just a loss. You can't, don't even go there.
Right.
Too many bad things can happen. It's right. Just unreasonable.
Yeah. So cut ties. And I will say, if this method of marketing is a value, right, so it feels like a loss to give it up, do what you can to look for similar plans, or maybe try to get somebody else interested in running a similar plan. I mean, hopefully there's options other than just giving up this particular market.
If it's worthy, there's someone else doing it, or you can create a substitute.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
All right. So any general thoughts on how and when to cut ties with these red flag people?
Yeah, so I think it's interesting. As a matter of personality, which is going to involve our emotional responses too, every person, I think, tends to be either too lenient or too severe in the question of when to cut ties with people. And there's problems with both, like, basically they're both errors, right?
And he's over there nodding and going, yeah.
Right. I mean, if you're too lenient with people and you don't cut ties with people when you should, then you're going to end up getting hurt by bad people, and you'll see days and weeks and months and even years consumed by those bad people. And that's really, really bad, right?
Resources, time, and maybe even your health.
Yeah, absolutely. But on the other hand, if you're too harsh and you cut ties too soon, then you're cutting yourself off from good people, and you're doing that in both direct and indirect ways. And the direct way is obvious, right? If I say, I'm not having anything more to do with you, Sally, then I'm cutting myself off from Sally. But if I get a reputation in my community as somebody who does that and does that unfairly, then good people are going to look at me and go, oh, I see some red flags there.
You're a red flag person now.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're might be developing a reputation for being too harsh, which can harm you.
So there's two failure modes that you really want to avoid here.
Yep.
Being too eager and too slow.
Yeah, yeah. The goal here is not to find a happy medium, right? What you need to do is make rational judgments, and rather than just kind of allowing your personality to dictate one way or the other. And the thing that I've been thinking about lately, and I think this is really, really important, is to distinguish basically decent but flawed people from rotten, sleazy people. There's a difference between people who are troublesome to deal with because they are not managing the failure modes of their personality adequately, like people who lose their temper and yell when they're under stress. This is inappropriate. It's wrong for people to do this. But there's a difference between those kinds of errors and people who are truly rotten and sleazy. They're trying to cheat and hurt you. They're trying to manipulate and control you, and they don't give a damn about how that you're getting the short end of the stick, that it's a win-lose relationship, win for them, lose for you.
Yeah, that's actually a nice distinction, because there's plenty of people around me who are basically decent, but they do have red flags that distract me and and make it difficult to deal with them, but those kinds are manageable. It's the ones who are really sleazy. It's like, those aren't worth even trying to manage. They're just dangerous.
Right. And I mean, sometimes people's failure modes are bad enough that you can say, look, I don't want to be friends with this person, or I sort of can't take this anymore. That's totally legitimate. But I do think there's a difference in there's a sort of like a regret and a distancing there, as opposed to hell no, I don't want to deal with this person anymore. So also know like what it means to either distance yourself or cut ties. I think there can be differences. It's not not that matters of personality or failure modes don't ever get bad enough that you shouldn't alter the relationship or create more distance. But there's a difference between those kinds of things and the people who are really like out to collect sacrifices from you.
So usually that's what I mean by management, is set them at some different distance than I had them originally. It's like, oh yeah, that's not the right distance for you. There are some people where the no distance is appropriate. It's all away, just gone.
Right. Yeah. Far, far, far away.
Contact.
Yeah. Right. Right.
All right.
Yeah, and I feel like this is something that, I don't know, hopefully I'm learning and learning to do better. And you know, it's here, I just turned 40, right? And I'm just figuring this out, so I'm feeling a little bit slow. But, you know, eventually I'll get there.
I'm older than you, and I'm messing it up, too. It's like, those red flags were the wrong kind. Damn it.
If you are messing this up, too, at home, don't worry. We all are. But just, I mean, I think the critical thing is to try to work on it and try to work on being more discerning about what's acceptable, what's tolerable versus not. Like, what is it that you can manage versus what is it that's just like, wow, I need to really stay away from that.
Yeah. People. All right, what's the take-home point?
This marketer is flying a slew of red flags. He seems dishonest, manipulative, and sleazy. Don't tolerate that or try to manage it. You'll lose. So cut ties and find better people to promote your work.
Indeed.
Hang on. I was not prepared for the conga, I'm sorry to say. And now I'm having trouble with the wrong thing. Okay, here we go.
All right, it's rapid-fire question time, where I put Diana on the hot seat, drawing questions from this long and growing queue in any old order I want. I'm the decider. And there's a lot less preparation, so interesting things could happen here. One just floated by in the chat that's kind of fun. Would you pay $10,000 for an 18K gold Apple Watch?
No, no, and more no. So I think this is asked by somebody who's not on Facebook, so they don't know the kinds of things that I say on Facebook. And like how ridiculously incompatible my life is with such finery.
Yeah.
I mean,
like, but you wouldn't pay $10,000 for any watch.
No.
Whether or not it's an Apple Watch.
No, and particularly
I would
not
either.
Like
I
the gold, like, but the gold plated stuff. Like,
ugh.
Yeah, no. No. Like, all the jewelry, like, I have earrings in, which are just little hoops that I've been wearing for like the last 2 years and haven't taken out. And I have my wedding ring and engagement ring, and that's my sum total of jewelry that I wear. And I'm not like, I mean, when I go out, when I go out, folks are lucky if I have showered recently, and I figure that's all the moral obligation that I owe you as opposed to smelling like the barn. And if I blow dried my hair and I put on makeup, that's fancy. So, yeah.
Oh, nice.
We're
just not in the target demographic for this kind
no.
of talk. I mean,
no.
Even assuming I have use cases for it, when I was watching the initial presentation of it, the gold and even the polished silver-ish metal one held no interest to me. The sport one, that one looked like it was passable. It's like, all right, that might have something for me. But, wow. Lighthearted one maybe to wrap it up since we're right at 10. Should children be taught about sexual sadism and masochism?
Lighthearted?
Good grief.
I know,
I know, I was being sarcastic.
This is a good grief question. No.
No.
I don't know. You need to tell six-year-old little Johnny that some people like to hurt each other or to be hurt in sexual context. Like, how is that not just incredibly confusing and inappropriate? Like, why would children need to know about this? Now, if you wish to talk about this with teenagers who are, like, you know, on the cusp of sexuality, like, hey, folks, this exists. And here's some things that you need to do if you wish to engage on this to keep yourself safe. By all means, I think that could be part of a young adult sexual education. Not in detail, right? But particularly, I think actually teaching the importance of safe words, I actually think that is very, very, very important. And it's if one engages in any kind of out there sexual activity, then like safe words really ought to be a part of it, any sort of role playing or anything like that. And so I absolutely think that is worth teaching, teaching young adults about.
In general, it seems like it would be, okay, the kiddos should developmentally appropriately learn about sexuality. And so really young kids, it's like, oh yeah, I came from mommy's tummy. Much later, here's the birds and bees. And I'm thinking much later, it's like, okay, and by the way, there are some people who, they've got different kinks, and probably not the funnest. here's the kind of range of goofiness. But that's just so that they're not shocked or surprised by somebody. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Trey says in the chat, my safe words are, no, stop, don't do that.
Thank you.
That's mine too, like, ow. Yeah, that was one of my key words.
I've never needed a safe word other than no thanks.
Yeah, but if you are engaging in sex where you might say that as part of the role that you're saying, then yes, you need a safe word. You need to be like, mashed potatoes, right?
Mashed potatoes, yeah. It's like, yeah. Definitely, whatever risky thing you might be doing, it same thing's true. Like martial artists, they have a gesture for tapping out. They actually
right.
tap out. And if somebody doesn't understand the need to tap out or doesn't respect someone's desire to tap out, bad, bad things happen. So this seems like a similar context.
Yeah.
Play safe.
Exactly.
Oh, okay, that was great. We should move on. I feel a little dirty. I don't like that.
Yeah, I do. There we go.
All right, it's time for us to sign off from another episode of Philosophy in Action Radio. Thanks for listening. We hope you all had a great time.
Thank you. That was a fun, laugh, lighthearted, rapid fire.
Lighthearted. We need a safe word.
I did have a fantastic. We need a safe word for the show. Mashed potatoes. Yeah.
Mashed potatoes is our new safe word.
Yeah. That'll be like the just don't go there, Greg. Mashed potatoes. Once again, thank you to our generous contributors. With every episode of Philosophy in Action Radio, we bring you the ideas that engage the mind and help you live better, and we do so in a intense, serious, professional way with absolutely no laughter or lightheartedness whatsoever.
It's the sheer professionalism that makes
exactly,
it what it is.
Exactly. So we think what we do is important, and we think it's valuable, and we do depend on your support. So if you want to contribute, just go to philosophyinaction.com/support.
Remember, we do welcome feedback on what we're doing well and what we could do better, too. Just email all the criticism to diana@philosophyinaction.com.
If you want to see what's on tap for the next few weeks, do visit philosophyinaction.com/upcoming. I will be broadcasting next Sunday on the 15th, but then the 22nd we will be skipping because that is SnowCon. So just to put that on your calendar.
SnowCon.
You have Sunday morning off on the 22nd.
22nd, Sunday morning off. Okay. I'm Greg Perkins, and you can find me online at objectivismseminar.com. The show features Dr. Diana Shea, and you can read her blog, Noodle Food, at philosophyinaction.com/blog. Please drop by to submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows, and then join us live here at the same time next week at philosophyinaction.com.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.